Tape 63, Side 1, House Judiciary, Subcommittee 3, May 10, 1979, 8:30 a.m., hearing and work session on House Bill 2758, Senate Bills 111 and 114.
Call to order Subcommittee 3 of the House Judiciary Committee, and the clerk will note those members present, all others are excused. Don't have anybody signed up on House Bill 2758. Is anybody here to testify on that? All right, we'll set that aside for the moment. Open the public hearing on Senate Bill 111. Judge Norblad.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Gary, Director of the Marion County Juvenile Department. He should be here shortly, so I'd like
okay.
to reserve the right to let some other people go.
Okay, that's fine, Gary. Lee Penny.
For the record, my name is Lee Penny. I'm Project Director of the Governor's Task Force on Juvenile Corrections. The two bills that you'll be hearing this morning are the two major proposals being made by the task force in the area of court disposition of juveniles. Senate Bill 111 would accomplish several major things. It would establish three types of dispositional alternatives: protective supervision and probation, both of which are mentioned in the present statute but without definition, and probation with suspended commitment, which actually is a form of disposition used by some juvenile courts now. It would establish an orderly and uniform procedure by which the court may modify or revoke juvenile probation. That is presently not in the statute. It would give the juvenile court authority to order specific care, placement, and supervision of a child committed to the custody of CSD. This has been a matter of controversy ever since CSD was set up in 1971. It's been the subject of several appellate court decisions. The language of present statute is ambiguous in many respects. This would clearly give authority to the court. One of the issues that has perhaps prevented or complicated the clarification of this particular issue is the fact that under Title 4A of the Social Security Act, the central state agency must be in charge of the care and treatment of a child if that child is to receive ADCFC payments. It was once thought that a state might imperil all of its Title 4A funds if this authority was given to the court.
Pardon me, what are Title 4A?
They are foster care payments for children who would otherwise be, if they were living in their own home, eligible for age-dependent children's aid. So it does not affect all children in the care and custody of CSD, but those who would have been or had previously been on ADC when they were removed from their home. It appears now in clarification from Department of Hugh and on the experience of other states that federal funds would be lost only in those individual cases where the court and CSD disagreed on the care and placement of a child and the court overruled CSD. It is estimated that the loss of federal funds would probably be minimal. This bill sets out the procedures by which the court and CSD shall negotiate those disputes, the hearing that will be held, but it does give clear final authority to the court. At present time, it does appear, both in the statute and the appellate court interpretations of the statute, that CSD has that authority. The court has the authority, of course, to remove the child from CSD's care. As a practical matter, that is not a recourse that the court can often take because, of course, the counties do not have the funds to maintain children in out-of-home care. The However, the legislature in 1975, I believe, did adopt additional language in that statute that said that even though a child is committed to care and custody of CSE, it does not relieve the court of the responsibility for continuing to protect the rights of the parent and child. However, it does specify what those rights may be. The task force hopes that this rewriting of 419.507 would clarify and those points. Mr. Pete, if he were here, would tell you that he is, I don't know often, but every now and then, subpoenaed into the courts around the state, show cause why his agency is not carrying out the orders of the court in respect to a particular child. However, apparently, statutorily, a CSE at the present time has the power to place the child as the CSE sees fit. This bill would also clarify another matter, and that is the question of whether a child who has been placed by the court with CSE, a child who has committed an offense, is still on probation to that court. It is certainly the opinion of some of the circuit court judges in the state, Judge Uragan and Yale and Vail, I believe Judge Norvine here in Marion County, and I believe the Douglas County judges, I believe the Juvenile Department Director of Douglas County will be here later this morning to talk about this, do believe that they have that authority. CSD has felt that it was not part of its responsibilities to carry out conditions of probation. This bill would clarify that since the court has the power to order specific care, placement, and treatment, it may also specify conditions of probation, which it would then be CSD's responsibility to see were carried out. Those are probably the main issues and features of this bill, and some of the rationale behind it.
Okay. Questions from members of the committee?
Well,
Representative Mason.
I received a letter from Mr. Michael Matern. And I'll read it for the record here. Our Citizens Advisory Committee has reviewed Senate Bill 111A in Gross and are concerned because the proposed bill does not provide authority for a juvenile court to place a child directly in the custody of a licensed private child care agency. Our advisory committee suggests the following amendment, Section 3, Subsection 3, Line 31, add, parend, deparend, place the child in the legal custody of a licensed private care agency. Because of purchase of care funding formulas, many children who need private agency services are placed in the custody of the Children's Services Division, which then arranges for the child to go to a private agency. Some children do not need to be fitted into that particular funding formula, and I think historically courts in Oregon have had the option of placing custody directly with the private agency without going through the Children's Services Division system.
Mr. Knickerbocker is here, and he may want to address that problem. There was some discussion of that in the interim. It was felt because virtually all of these children will have to be paid for by funds administered by CSD, that it would be better to continue the present practice of committing to CSD, but specifying, if the court wished, that CSD should place that child in a specific setting.
Well, let me ask you this. Would this bill require that the court always go through CSD regardless of where the child ended up? I certainly hope
yes,
it doesn't.
Yes, or they could, of course, place the child, say, with relatives or something of that nature if no public expense was to be involved. The issue is almost always that public expense will be involved in out-of-home placement of a child, and CSD is, in effect, the broker for those services. It was felt that if every circuit court in the state had the power to place directly into a private agency, and then CSD would find out later that that child was there and begin to be billed for it, they would have no central control, nor would they know what slots were open in those agencies at any given time, nor what their financial obligations might be at any given time. And so it was felt by the task force that putting the children through CSD would be about the only orderly way you could manage the funds, and keeping track of the available placements. CSD might have a child in its care and custody that it planned to put into Tucker Cottage, say, and arrived at Tucker Cottage and found that three or four circuit courts had already put children into places that they thought were available, just as an example of what might occur.
Well, orderly order is always a nice sounding phrase, but I'm very, very suspicious when everyone personally, I'm a little very leery of CSC because of what I think is, I think sometimes it can be so all encompassing. I think it's bad government, to take away all, concentrate so much power in one agency.
This bill would, of course, as a matter of fact, somewhat lessen CSC's authority.
How is that?
Because it would give the power to the court to order specific placement if the court wished. Right now, the court, except for sending a child to a training school, the court simply commits to CSD, and CSD places the child where, in the opinion of the caseworker, is most appropriate, or where there's a place available. The court does not commit to any residential care facility at the present time, or can it certainly in negotiation and in a dispositional hearing, certainly CSD brings in its recommendations to the court, and in 9 times out of 10 it's accepted by the court. There is that tenth time where Mr. Peake gets subpoenaed and troubles erupt. Certainly, the courts do rely heavily upon CSD's advice on casework, and of course their own staff, the juvenile department staff. But this would give final authority to the court, and the court does not have that authority.
Any further questions, Lee? I know it's not contained in this bill, but it raises a question that I know that my juvenile department and juvenile judges in Jackson County have raised for a couple of sessions now, and I just would like your general views of it, and that is with regards to giving the court authority over the parents of the child where the court, deems that it would be workable, and that the court could make good use of that authority. Of course, it wouldn't apply in every case, probably wouldn't apply in the majority of cases. I know our judges feel that in some cases it would be very helpful if they had legal authority, legal jurisdiction over the parents of the child to involve the parents in a probationary program with the child.
The task force did consider Judge Sawyer's recommendation and looked at some statutes of some other states on that. In the final analysis, they did reject that proposal, so it is not among our bills. I think some problems arise, and I'm not a lawyer, so I can't discuss it learnedly, but arise over compelling certain actions of a person who themselves may not have committed any offense. I think that was what troubled the task force about the proposal and led ultimately to its defeat.
Do you feel that the task force rejected it principally on that legal ground rather than on a policy ground as to whether or not it would, you know, it would be good policy to allow it?
I think many of the task force members were concerned about that same problem. And because many of them, of course, work in the field and have the experience of a non-cooperating parent,
mm-hmm.
and the difficulty involved in treating a child if you can't treat the child in the context of the family. But we're very concerned about how it could be done and still protect the rights of the parents to in effect act as they saw fit in the absence of a jurisdiction over the parent for an offense.
Mm-hmm.
And they say they looked at several different models and were not pleased with any of them ultimately. Rejected.
Are there other states that do provide for that kind of jurisdiction?
Trying to think. We looked at an Ohio statute, and I would need to go back and look at it again to refresh my memory on just what its approach was. I do know it differed somewhat from Judge Sawyer's, but I hesitate to try to outline to you now. It's been perhaps a year since I've looked at it, and I'm at least back with that again. That was the major model that we found in other statutes. There may be others, but that was the major one that we found. I could look that up, make a copy for you.
Do you have any opinion yourself, notwithstanding, say, the possible jurisdictional concerns, as to whether or not such jurisdiction, such authority in the court may in some instances be helpful?
I think it might be. There were some members of the task force who argued that they did not feel that, they felt that therapy and help were only going to be effective in a voluntary situation.
Mm-hmm.
And that if some legal means could be found to compel parents to attend the counseling sessions or compel parents to be certain places at certain times and do certain things, they felt that if they had made so little contact with these people that this sort of compulsion was necessary, they didn't feel that the treatment or therapy or counseling or whatever was being offered to this family would be effective, that it would be offered in a coercive atmosphere that could be counterproductive. Now, you know, that was based on some of casework experience, and both Jewel Goddard and Guy Hancock both expressed that feeling based on their years of casework in the field. That they were much more likely to recommend a conciliatory policy in an effort to draw the people into the program through persuasion rather than coercion.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Okay, thanks, Lee.
Mm-hmm.
Judge Norblad?
Basically, my name's Al Norblad. I'm a juvenile judge from Marion County. Senate Bill 111. To state, most of the judges that I've talked to, and I think the most of the juvenile directors, strongly support this bill. They feel it's a good one. They feel it gives good alternatives. It allows for some community-based things, particularly in regards to restitution, community service, and compulsory attendance at remedial courses in regards to alcohol, in regards to marijuana. And this is a real iffy area now as to whether or not we can do it. and it clears that up to a great degree. And I think it's an exceptionally good bill. The other aspect that has always been a bone of contention between CSC and the judges is that who has the authority as to placements into foster care, shelter care, or group care. And I think this clears it up quite well. It sets out some standards and some guidelines that everybody can follow. Of course, the judges obviously like it because it ultimately leaves the decision up to them. But at least it sets it out and we don't end up in a fight as to where a child will or will not go. And it sets out standards and methods for people to work together between CSD and the court personnel and ultimately come up with something that's probably in the best interest of the child. The only concern I have is on page 5, line 27, is that the treatment plan must be within 14 days. Sometimes it should be shorter, and I hope that this doesn't affect it, that we can't require shorter treatment plans. When you have a child that's seriously acting out and in serious problems, sometimes we have to have things done quite a bit shorter than that.
Where was that, Judge?
Page 5, down on section 6, line, beginning of line 25, right?
27. Recommendation must be received by the court within 14 days. I assume you can get one earlier if requested.
Sounds like that's the maximum.
Yeah, I hope so. You know, when you send it, when you've got a child that's really acting out quite serious and send them to state hospital and they send them back in 3 days cured, you need to come up with a plan quickly to place them someplace else.
Okay. Questions?
Yes.
Joan? Well, excuse me, Representative Mason.
Judge Norbert, what's your reaction to the proposed amendment here of the that I've read Mr. Matern's letter saying that the courts have the authority to place the child in legal custody of the licensed child care agency?
Without going through?
Apparently.
I assume that would be without going through CSD.
I think the assumption that CSD is always going to pay is not correct. I mean, it's one of the things that bothers me about the trend in this area is it's all encompassing. CSD is the mother to all the children.
We use some private care agencies without going through CSD right now, and I don't have authority to do that.
Well, that's the purpose of the amendment, is to preserve that authority.
Okay, which would be like using Pitchford, or if the people have enough private funding that they can go to their own group care agency, or if in fact 121 passes and there's enough funds there, we would certainly consider opening our own group care facility and not go through CSD. So I suppose it would be appropriate from those type of cases. But I think that if CSD is going to end up ultimately paying for that particular child, they ought to have some say-so in it. I think it's only fair. Maybe half it should be only as to those where it's non-CSD funding. I don't know, Glenn.
Yeah, I'll ask Glenn to come up after and respond to that. Further questions? Joan?
On page 3, subsection E, paragraph B, subsection 1, section 3, page 3, lines 3 through 9, on restitution. Gives the court the authority to order a juvenile to pay an insurer. Isn't it true that adult criminals who are ordered to pay restitution cannot be ordered to pay an insurance?
Yes. In fact, I think it was my suggestion that was put in. There's a provision, the restitution theory in adult court is to make the victim whole again.
Right.
So if the victim receives insurance, there's no need for the defendant to make the payment. And frankly, right now, I order restitution to the insurance companies. And I'm not sure how strong or grounds I am, because they might apply adult law to juveniles and say, no, you can't do this. My theory on restitution is that I'm not out to help the victim. To me, the significance is to make the child pay the consequences of his act.
Isn't that just a fine?
Well, no, he's, okay, I suppose you could call it that. He's paying the consequences of his act in the fact that he is paying for the damage that he did. And many, many cases, the parents are willing to pay the victim off immediately and just clear it up, and I don't allow it. As far as I'm concerned, the child has to work for it, pay it back themselves, and I won't allow parents to pay it. So I don't look at it from the victim's standpoint. I look at it from the child's standpoint of his understanding the consequences of the damage he did, the cost of the damages he did, and to have to pay those damages back.
But the legislature has set the policy of restitution as being to make the victim whole or compensate the victim, certainly in adult cases. And why should
true.
It be different in
true.
Juvenile cases?
True.
Except, as Representative Mason says, if it's a disguised fine.
I don't consider it a disguised fine. I consider it because a fine has no relationship to the actual damage done.
Okay.
In a speeding ticket?
Statutory provisions regarding fines specifically state, because take into consideration what the defendant received from the crime or what profit the defendant received. I just argued fines over the Court of Appeal and lost,
sure.
by the way. That,
of course, I don't look at restitution that way, because if there is no damage, I don't order it. So I have no requirements there. So it's not an attempt to make the victim whole, it's an attempt for the child to understand the consequences of his act. If he goes in and does serious damage to a house, to find out what those damages are and what the consequences are and what he should be paid for. And I suppose you can say, if you want to carry this further, you can say the next one, subsection F, is a form of fine, only you're working it out. We use this right now in Marion County. First-time shoplifting, minor crimes, we have the children go out and work for the senior citizens. Right now they're delivering wood on Saturdays, senior citizens in North Salem. And the subsection G, we also do that now. We have classes in drugs and alcohol, and we require the children to attend those. They're at Chemeca Community College. And in fact, they pay the cost of the class.
Other questions? Al, what do you think of Judge Sawyer's proposal with regards to jurisdiction over the parents?
I think we have jurisdiction now over somebody that has custody of the child. There's a statute that says we can order the custodian to do certain things. And I take that in the light that we can, if the child is left in the home, we can order certain things. And I will order it, and I find it very effective, and I think it becomes significant, particularly in cases where the parents have really got an alcohol problem. And I can get them on antabuse or something like this, where they're abusive to the child, real serious drinking. The problem arises, such as if they've got alcohol problems or just general parenting skills, that if you remove the child and place them in foster care, group home, or McLaren or Hillcrest, at that juncture you can't order the parents to get their act together to ultimately get the child back in that home.
Mm-hmm.
And you end up having to look at very, very expensive foster care or some other alternative program as opposed to putting them back in the home. And I think ultimately it would be best for the child, and I think it would save the state a lot of money if we could require parents to, in essence, get their act together so we get that child back in the home.
Would you, if you had that authority, then what would you use? Contempt to enforce it?
That's correct.
What if you get them to attend a program, but they just, for various reasons, aren't mentally or emotionally willing to accept and carry out the program? The old, you can lead them to counseling, but whether it's going to do any good.
I suppose that at that juncture, we'd have to say that it's going to be foster care or some other placement. A lot of times, you can get these people into programs for a short period of time. The initial aspects of a lot of these programs, particularly your alcohol programs, are to make them aware of the problem so that they'll seek their own help.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Muriel Goldman.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Muriel Goldman, and I'm legislative chairman for Citizens for Children, a child advocacy organization. I'm speaking in support of Senate Bill 111, both on behalf of Citizens for Children and from my experience on the Governor's Task Force on Juvenile Corrections. The task force, on the basis of research and testimony during its year of work, adopted several general policy statements to provide a framework for its recommendations. The following policy statements appearing on pages 13 through 14 of the task force report provide a framework for Senate Bill 111. In statement number 3, it says that the placement and treatment of a child found to have committed a status or criminal offense should be determined on the basis of the best interest of the child, taking into consideration the child's due process rights and the safety of the community. Statement number 8 says that when a child is removed from his home, preference should be given to treating the child in a facility in or near his own community if such placement is in the child's best interest. And statement number 12 says that Oregon's juvenile justice system should be coordinated so that a child, when removed from the home, receives a thorough and adequate evaluation, which results in a consistent treatment plan. B, a child is sent to the minimum number of placements that accomplish this treatment plan. And C, whenever possible, a child remains under the supervision of the same counselor or caseworker during the treatment period in order to benefit from consistency of approach. Senate Bill 111 was also designed to address the following problem areas identified by the task force. Children often appear to be placed in available space rather than appropriate programs. On frequent occasions, there appears to be a lack of quick, effective response on the part of CSD when its services are needed. There is a need for evaluating youth to determine the most effective dispositional alternatives and to coordinate planning in order to achieve treatment objectives. And finally, there is a need to clarify the division of authority between CSD and the courts, which you've already heard about. Senate Bill 111 addresses these policy and problem statements in the following manner. It establishes three types of dispositional alternatives by giving precise definitions to the existing alternatives of probation and protective supervision and adding probation with suspended commitment. The type of disposition and placement will be based on the court's findings concerning a particular child's conduct or condition. Other dispositional options which have been expanded or codified include restitution and community service. It establishes an orderly, uniform procedure with guarantee of due process rights by which the court may modify or revoke juvenile probation. It gives the juvenile court authority to order specific care, placement, and supervision of a child committed to the custody of CSD. And in the event there is disagreement between CSD and the court, it gives the court final say in the matter. Specifies that CSD shall supervise children on probation and provide care and placement of the juvenile court so ordered. Finally, it expands the present requirement that CSD prepare a treatment plan for submission to the court within 14 days for those in need of medical care or special treatment to all children committed by the court. And it extends the present requirement that CSD report to the court annually on special cases to all children placed with CSD by the court. Citizens for Children recommend support of Senate Bill 111. I'll be happy to answer any questions. When you first asked it, my original reaction was that the legislation already included that option. As I look at it more closely, it doesn't really say that. And I suspect that it probably is a legitimate concern. I wonder if you might be able to address it on page 3, lines 27 through 28, where it says that direct that the child be placed in the legal custody of some relative or some person maintaining a foster home approved by the court or else licensed by CSD to operate as a foster home or private agency. That would take care of an organization such as the Casey Foundation.
Other questions? Let me ask you, Mrs. Goldman, about the Sawyer proposal, and I understand Lee Penny says you did discuss it.
Yes, that's right.
If you, setting aside for the minute the legal jurisdictional question, do you have any opinion as to whether in some types of cases, and, I wouldn't pretend that it would be appropriate in the majority of cases, but that in some types of cases that giving the court jurisdictional authority over the parents may happen in the dispositional phase.
Okay. I guess I have mixed feelings about it, Mr. Chairman. As Lee said, we were concerned about the legal ramifications, but we were also concerned about, in the case of a child who's committed a criminal act, whether if you force the parents to participate, and if they're not willing to participate, how much you would really accomplish. Also, if the bill is passed and it says that the court can order specific placement and care and so forth, the court could recommend, say, if they were placing the child in custody of CSD, that CSD includes the parents in the treatment plan. There were some people who came before the task force who were parents of children who had been involved in the juvenile justice system and had been sent to some kind of treatment programs or to a youth care center. And they were concerned that frequently they were left out of the treatment plan and they would have liked to have participated. And I suspect that the majority of the parents of children who come under the juvenile court jurisdiction feel that way. And I'm not sure that it would be as much of a problem as one might think. We did discuss, after the task force decided as a task force to reject the notion of adopting Judge Sawyer's recommendation, we did discuss some other ways of addressing it, not so much for a child who committed a criminal act, but for a child who was a status offender, that since the court doesn't have to accept a status offender and deal with it, the court could say to a parent that, really, if the court feels that the part of the reason the child has committed the status offense is due to parental behavior rather than just the child's behavior. They could say that if you want us to be involved, then we would expect you to do such and such. But it didn't get much beyond the discussion stage, and we did decide to reject Judge Sawyer's recommendation.
But did you feel that the rejection was based primarily on the legal question, the legal jurisdiction question?
Yes, primarily on the legal question, but also somewhat on how can you compel a parent to participate? And if they don't want to, what will you have?
Yeah, I think you'd have to look very closely at every case and make a determination that I guess pretty much guess whether or not in advance that you've got a parent who's got such a deep-seated problem that the hand of the law is just not going to do any good. I think
I did happen to sit in on a preliminary trial of a status offense case because I'm on the Multnomah County Juvenile Court Advisory Council, and they've asked us to do this to become more familiar with the operations of the court. In this particular situation, it was quite obvious that relations between that particular child and the parents had so broken down that there was very little that the court could do to resolve the problem at that point. And so forcing the parents to participate, I doubt if they could have accomplished very much because it was everyone was yelling at one another, the child and the parents, and they were yelling at the counselor, CSD, and the juvenile court counselor, and it was beyond any kind of repair whatsoever. So I think you would have to look at the individual situation. But I really was impressed with the testimony from parents of children who have been in trouble, who indicated they wanted to participate.
That's the other side of the coin.
Yeah.
It's parents who want to be involved and feel that they're being excluded.
That's right. And so I don't know whether it's so much that the court should be forcing them as that whatever agency is dealing with that family, that they look at involving the parent in the process.
Yep. know, knowing Judge Sawyer, I think in his situation, if the parents wanted to be involved, he'd make sure they were. Any other questions? Okay, thanks,
thank you,
Muriel. Glenn, do you want to come up and respond, I think, to Representative Mason's suggestion on that proposed amendment?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Glenn Knickerbocker with Children's Services Division. As I understood Representative Mason's concern, I think I agree that looking at the language now, it would be questionable whether the judge has the authority to directly place a child in the care of a private agency when there's no subsidy coming from the state. In Mr. Matern's case, he works for a agency that is totally privately financed, and there are all of the children in their agency are placed under private funding, and so I would certainly suggest the committee might want to adopt that amendment.
Questions?
Anybody else wish to testify on Senate Bill 311? Okay, I'll close the hearing on 311. Open a hearing on Senate Bill 114, Lee Penny.
Senate Bill 114 is the task force recommendation on informal disposition. In the statistical survey which the task force did, showed that well over 50%, and certainly in some counties as many as 80% of children referred to the juvenile department are handled informally. That is, they never appear before the judge. That may include case being closed at intake, or there being a single conference with the child and the parents, or letter to the parents, or it may involve a considerable length of time and certain curtailments on the child's freedom of action and association. Present statute provides for this only in a phrase that is something about the court may make such informal recommendations to the child and the parent if it seems appropriate or something of that nature, and it doesn't address in any other way a procedure which actually affects the majority of the children referred to the court. This would simply set forth a procedure by which a child will be placed under informal or non-judicial probation. It would protecting both the right of the child and the right of the court to act by filing a petition and having a hearing in appropriate circumstances. It would set time limitations on it. If the child behaved for a period of 6 months, if the probationary period would come to an end, or up to 6 months, it wouldn't have to be 6 months. There is provision here for renewing the agreement for an additional 6 months in case of violation. Specifies that this is voluntary on the part of the child. The child can, whenever it wishes, he or she wishes, request and receive a hearing if the child felt that would be beneficial. That the juvenile department counselor may revoke for cause, but participation in an informal agreement would not be considered an admission of guilt. Nor could it be entered in evidence against the child subsequently.
Chairman.
Representative Mason.
What participation does the district attorney have in this?
It isn't specified.
That's why I asked.
Yeah. Simply because the district attorney's role in juvenile court isn't really specified in the present juvenile code. And whereas in some counties, a district attorney, there's a deputy district attorney right at the JDH and participates in a majority of cases where there's criminal behavior. In other counties in the state, the district attorney rarely, if ever, appears in juvenile court and has minimal involvement. So it It is not addressed in this bill, but it isn't really addressed. The role of the district attorney is not addressed in the juvenile code itself.
Well, what about the situation? I, first glance, I think it's probably a good bill.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it reflects what's being done at the time, although that's,
right.
If it indeed is already being done, I would ask why we need the bill, but regardless of that.
Mm-hmm.
What about the situation where, let's say I'm representing a child or a child has through his own resources negotiated a informal disposition of the case with the juvenile court counselor, and your friendly local district attorney decides to object. We're gonna continue on with this petition, and you better show up at such and such a date. You know, will the child be able to bring in this agreement and then essentially demur to the petition and say this is inappropriate, this has been set aside. I do see a problem. There's got to be some switch, you know, circuit breaker mechanism in here. Is it the idea that the juvenile court counsel and the child resolve it on a very informal basis and that it's not used as evidence against the child? There's no admission of guilt, which
mm-hmm.
is a very good part of this bill. I guess that's one of the reasons why this bill would be needed, because I have seen these agreements that require an admission of guilt.
My assumption would be that since the law says that any person may file a petition in juvenile court, there would be nothing to preclude the district attorney from proceeding and filing a petition. Since the existence of this agreement could not be used in evidence against the child, child would not necessarily be harmed by having entered into the agreement, but I would imagine the petition filed by the district attorney would supersede an informal agreement of this nature, if that is the counsel and the district attorney could not agree. Now, this matter comes up, you know, this is a matter that exists all the time now. Decisions have to be made in every one of these kids. How are we going to handle it?
Judge Norblatt has
Judge Norblatt, why don't you come on up?
The district attorney is only there to aid the court. So ultimately, the district attorney can only do that which the court allows it to do in the first place. In the second place, if the district attorney desires to file a petition as a private party, then the court has a right to review it, and we can dismiss it or not accept it. And at least in Marion County, I think at one time that this has happened, and we just frankly consider it a grandstand play on the part of the district attorney, and I just dismissed it out of court.
The question I have for you is, as a member of the bench, is do you think you need some language in here saying the court may dismiss a petition on, you know, after appropriate hearing or whatever it is, on grounds that the agreement has been entered into, and you're not going to, there's some days not going to be the grandstanding DA that's going to say no and take it up on appeal and say that this is abuse of discretion to dismiss a perhaps well-founded petition on the grounds that an informal agreement has been entered into. Not that the DA would ever do that.
I don't know if it's really necessary. I think the court has the right to accept or not to accept the petition. And I think we already have that right under statute. You know, if we didn't have that right, we would have every neighbor or every mad grandparent or every irate citizen filing petitions. And it would be absolutely frightening what we'd be hearing. We've got to have some control over what petitions are filed.
What about remand? Let's say there's a situation where the district attorney has decided to seek a remand on the juvenile, and there's disagreements in there. Maybe I'm going too far afield, but
Remand is a decision by the court whether to file it, whether to request a remand study.
And I have again gotten into this position where I think the district attorney's requested inappropriate remands, and I've just not allowed them, not even considered a study. We do all of this right now anyway. We have an average case filing, I don't know, we have an average referral rate of maybe 400, 450 cases a month, and out of those we'll file 100 to 130 petitions. So we're dealing with two-thirds of them informally anyway now.
Well, the language just says that whereby the child agrees to fulfill certain conditions in exchange for not having a petition filed again. Child, so that would probably be the authority right there to dismiss the petition, wouldn't it?
Yeah, if child, okay, I hadn't looked at it. What section?
Page 2, line 11 and 12.
I would agree with you. I would agree. So one of the things you people in your interim committee took up was the position of the district attorney's office. They requested a lot stronger authority in there. You people considered it and denied it. Mm-hmm. So there are no bills to give the district attorney's office any additional authority. The interim committee came to the conclusion that what they had now was fine.
Are we gonna?
Well, my recollection also is that there is, if not disagreement, certainly in many of our areas, no desire on the part of the district attorney to be any further involved in these matters. So it was dropped.
I think to an extent it depends on the county, and in the Multnomah County situation, the district attorney has been very institutionalized into the whole juvenile court system, in that it's not just the DA showing up to handle a juvenile matter. There are four DAs
that are
residents.
That's
all they do, and they've become very, they think of it in terms of this is, you do either do burglaries or you do juvenile. It's not mm-hmm. the exception for them to do juvenile.
Marion County has, we're big enough, we have the same thing. And if you have defense attorneys on the other side appearing all the time, you've got to have that DA there preparing the petitions, seeing if there's any suppression issues, making sure the proper witnesses are there. As long as the hearings are as legalistic as they are and as formal as they are, and certainly they should be,
mm-hmm.
The fact is the state should have somebody there to make sure that their side's doing it right.
I think we felt in the interim that the present arrangement was working well, and that there was no need to mandate it statewide because it certainly was not required elsewhere.
Well, Chairman, I think I should point out that there's going to come a time when the child and the defense child attorney of the child is going to strike a bargain with the juvenile court counsel, and the district attorney is not going to like it. And mm-hmm. that's going to be a real, it's going to be interesting when the DA runs head on into that little phrase. Not that it'll break my heart, but
we have a procedure for that now. We have our district attorney reviews all this, and if they get into a big hassle or a total disagreement, why, they then come in to me and I'll arbitrate.
Mm-hmm. Well, although this language, I think, would give more authority to the counselor, almost prosecutorial discretion to the counselor, it seems like.
Of course, they have that now.
Okay, any further questions? Okay, thank you very much. Claudia Burton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Claudia Burton of Salem, Oregon, representing the ACLU of Oregon. I did serve as an associate member on the task force. The task force had amongst its conclusions, a rather strong preference for informal, low-level intervention and treatment in the community when appropriate, on the belief that very frequently, the more deeply the youngster penetrated into the system, the worse it was for everyone involved. We stated that as one of our controlling policies in our report, and it is contained as a major policy in 121, which is the Community Juvenile Services Act, which was our main piece of legislation. There are two bills dealing with informal, keeping out of the full judicial process kinds of procedures. One that we have before us today, 114, dealing with what is sometimes called department probation, here called informal disposition, and another which is out of Senate Judiciary and presently in Ways and Means about diversion, the difference between the two being the degree of voluntariness. As Lee Tenney said, informal dispositions are very common. They're thought to have a lot of advantages. They are certainly less expensive. They are the disposition of choice and practice in probably over 50% of the referrals to juvenile departments in Oregon. There are some dangers in them that concern civil libertarians. And I'm not here to complain about this bill. I'm here to support it because this is about the best bill on this subject I've ever heard about. It's just excellent, I think, in its limitation in time, its insistence that the process is voluntary, the fact that the youngster is advised of his right to counsel, the limitation on obtaining an admission from the youngster, and I want to support it wholeheartedly. An additional comment that sort of ends the statement. An additional comment on the point that Representative Mason was discussing with Judge Norblad. As I had not considered that question before it came up today, I had just assumed that if the youngster entered into this understanding with the juvenile department, that was the quid pro quo. No petition filed. Of course, it will be filed if the youngster doesn't complete the agreement. That isn't, as I read it, precisely what Section 2 says. It does say, in exchange for not having a petition filed against the child, and I would assume that agreement would bind the juvenile counselor and the juvenile department, and no doubt the judge would be in sympathy with that agreement, because I have no doubt that the counselor and the department will be operating pursuant to understandings with the juvenile judge as to what policies he or she wants followed in this area. But that's a two-party agreement, and I would not think it would bind third parties such as the district attorney. So I don't believe that necessarily he would be, or she would be, the district attorney, bound by that language. I would think, as a practical matter, the juvenile judge would be unlikely to view with much sympathy a petition that was filed under those circumstances.
Okay, any questions?
Thanks,
Claudia. Muriel Goldman.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Muriel Goldman. Again, I'm both representing Citizens for Children and also having worked on the Governor's Task Force on Juvenile Correction. And I'm testifying in support of Senate Bill 114. As you heard in a statistical survey of the juvenile justice system, the task force found that although it varied among counties, informal dispositions accounted for at least 50% of the youth referred to the courts in 1977. Not all counties reported their closed intake cases, and some counties count each charge against a child as a separate referral. So it is probable that informal dispositions actually account for a higher percentage than the figures might indicate. For example, in Multnomah County, of an estimated 11,484 children referred in 1978, they state that about 80% were handled informally. Informal disposition, the way it is practiced now, varies widely from one county to another. It is totally open-ended and could be subject to abuse. It may last for several months with various restrictions placed on the child's activities and associations. Senate Bill 114, if enacted, would lend uniformity to the informal disposition procedure and protect the interests of both the child and the court by specifying in writing the process, the expectations, and the time commitment. It allows the child to revoke the agreement if he or she feels the court hearing would be beneficial. It also allows the juvenile department counselor to revoke the agreement if the child fails to carry out the agreed-upon terms or if a subsequent offense is committed. It further allows for modification or extension of the agreement for an additional 6 months with the consent of the child and the child's attorney if the child fails to carry out the terms of that agreement. What is most significantly different from present law, in our opinion, is the following. It provides for uniformity of time limits and, as a result, more equal treatment. It does not require admission of guilt, nor can the agreement be used as evidence of guilt in subsequent adjudicatory hearings. And the child and the child's parents or guardian must be informed of the child's right to counsel and to court-appointed counsel if indigent. And the right to counsel attaches prior to entering into an informal disposition agreement. I don't have a whole lot to add to what has already been stated by the previous speakers in terms of what would happen if the district attorney decides to file a petition. In Multnomah County, at least, the court worked very closely with the DAs who were on the premises. And in preparing the petition, they looked to the DA to determine if there is sufficiency in order to file a petition, so that in most cases of informal disposition or informal probation, the counselor who makes that decision usually has an idea ahead of time that either there isn't sufficient evidence to file a petition or that in this particular case it would be more appropriate for the child to be treated in an informal manner. And Citizens for Children urges your support of Senate Bill 114.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? All right, thank you, Ms. Holman. Anybody else wish to testify on Senate Bill 114? I know, Judge Narblad, you responded to some questions and you weren't signed up. Do you wish to testify
no,
any further
I
on it?
I didn't.
Okay, all right. Anybody else wish to testify on Senate Bill 114? All right, thank you. Joan, I note I have in my file apparently a copy of a parts of a letter from Judge Beckett, I think was sent to Representing Frohnmeyer, and he had suggested some some amendments, but we obviously don't have enough people here for work session, and and he's of course not here to testify, nor is Representative Frohnmeyer. I just suppose we probably ought to take these up, move it to the have the full committee. Or do you think we should work on it in the
I don't have a copy of the letter, so I don't even know what the amendments are.
You know, I'm not even sure where I got mine. I just opened up my file and found this in here, and I really don't know. I would, for the information of those who are present in the audience, well, I'll just read shortly what Judge Beckett's recommendations were, and you can ponder them, although I don't think we will not act on them today. Senate Bill 114 provides for informal disposition. We think we have a successful informal program without the necessity of specific provisions in the law. However, with some modification, the bill may provide for a uniform guideline throughout the state. The modifications are, he says in Section 1, stop after, quote, referred to a county juvenile department. That would be line 5. It is difficult enough for judges to determine probable cause, and untrained counselors ought not to be placed in this position. So that's his first suggestion. Second suggestion on Section 3, subparagraph 5, line 24, he urges be deleted. He says, if the agreement is part of the juvenile's record, Section 3G, isn't make sense. It ought also to be considered by the judge at any dispositional hearing. And his third suggestion is Section 6 should be deleted. If an attorney is appointed, it is doubtful that an informal agreement could be developed. The appointed attorney, as a matter of obligation, would be trying to have no petition filed and no further action taken by the department. Or the attorney would be forcing the department to file and prove the allegations, knowing that even if proven, the ultimate disposition would differ little from the terms of an informal agreement. Issues of restitution, community service, and treatment would take considerable time and bargaining, which ultimately would detract from the benefits supposedly to be derived from an informal approach. This is not meant as an adverse statement about attorneys. Quite to the contrary, attorneys by their very nature and training find it difficult to treat anything informally. Thus, there is a built-in conflict in attempting to establish an informal process and include attorneys as part of the process. Yeah. Those are Judge Beckett's suggestions. I will leave those for work session. I think I can anticipate how the witnesses would respond to those suggestions without calling them. All right. I think I'll close the hearing then on Senate Bill 114. I'll go back. Representative Rutherford, we had House Bill 2758 on, and somebody said that that was your bill.
That was a bill that was put in at the request of a constituent of mine, yes. Was this the time for the hearing on?
Yeah. This was set for... I think we had it set one other time for hearing, too, and nobody showed up. What do you wish to do?
It's addressed with the Civil Procedure Code, and I think that since the person that asked me to request the bill has not appeared, I think I'd just let it sit.
Okay. Close the hearing then on House Bill 2758. Any further business we brought before the committee announcements? You mentioned that the Douglas County...
Yeah, the juvenile director. Lee's gone to call to find out whether he's on his way. Apparently it's foggy down south, so he may not. I don't know
what... He was going to come up on 111?
Yeah. I don't know what we can do.
Yeah, I don't either. Well, I'd say this. we've got a caucus at 10 o'clock.
Oh.
But I suppose, you know, if he's here for purposes of taking testimony, I'll recess the meeting and be available to come back and take his testimony. I'm sorry that things went as quickly as they did, but we, of course, have no control over that.
Well,
not really.
Originally, when Lee told me that he was coming, she said that he wouldn't be able to be here at 8:30, but he wanted to be able to testify before 10 o'clock, so... But we may be finding out that he's not coming at all.
He shows up, let us know.
Yeah, why don't you do that? I will simply recess the hearing, and then if he shows up, we'll be in our offices until 10.
Yeah.
And then at 10, we'll be in room 357. You can just knock on the door and call us out, and... we'll come back to take his testimony on that. All right, we'll declare recess.
Reason for recess is moved and subcommittee is implicitly adjourned. The time is 10:15.